This is Ryan Fitzpatrick, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 21 of the Neil Reynolds Podcast. Hope you're enjoying it. If you are, please spread the word, give us a rating and a review on iTunes. It all helps. This week, our special guest is a Super Bowl champion, a two-time Pro Bowler. He caught over 500 passes in the NFL as one of the best wide receivers of his generation. It's Greg Jennings from the Green Bay Packers and the Minnesota Vikings. Finished off his career with the Miami Dolphins. He's now a TV commentator, and he's very, very honest. He's always been very forthright. I met Greg on an NFL UK live tour in the summer of 2016. Then we worked together on Sky Sports. I think he's great, and I think he's a great broadcaster now. So let's get into it. And you know, as we begin with most conversations on the Neil Reynolds Podcast, I started my chat with Greg, where it all began, his experiences of first playing football. Despite going on to enjoy a fine career in the NFL, let's just say it wasn't exactly love at first sight when it came to football.
For me, football was it was something that I only entertained when I was a young kid due to my friends playing the sport. I had no desire to play football. I was claustrophobic. Every time I watched the sport, I felt like there was a big pile on, and I just could imagine myself being at the bottom of the pile, being claustrophobic, and just kicking and pushing and doing whatever was necessary to remove myself from the bottom of the pile. So I had no interest in football.
It kind of worked out all right in the end. So when did you start getting into it then?
It did. So I was about 11 or 12. I jumped in. My friends, like I said, they were playing, and I was a basketball guy. I thought football was going to mess up my jump shot, and they convinced me to play. And my first time playing organized football, I was an offensive guard.
Oh, stop.
And
it.
I was irate. I was so upset because I was the fastest guy on our little rocket team, and I was one of the bigger guys, but I felt like I should be carrying the football. Like I didn't sign up to play this sport to put my hand in the dirt. I'm sorry.
No one really wants to be an offensive lineman, do they?
I mean, no, I really don't believe so. I really don't. That's not how we all envision ourselves when we think about, I want to play football.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So then you moved through high school. What about college? What was that process like going from high school to college? Did you kind of, when did you realize I can go and play at Western Michigan or play at a decent school in college?
So for me in high school, I played running back up until my, I believe my sophomore year. And we didn't have a receiver on our varsity team. And so I told the coach, I can catch. I moved to receiver, started playing receiver and progressed, had a lot of success. And gained a lot of interest from a lot of schools, mainly Big Ten schools. I won't even get into the story about how I committed to the University of Michigan, sat down with Lloyd Carr in his office with my dad, and then they reneged on me. I'm not going to even get into it, Neil.
Could be like therapy. Then, tell me all about it.
it was one of those deals where once I started getting this kind of recognition from the bigger schools in both sports, both basketball and football, more basketball than it was even football, I kind of felt like, okay, this can definitely be a thing. Like I can definitely get to this next phase, which was collegiate football or sport. And once that happened, you know, I fell back on an opportunity that Western Michigan had always left open, ended up being at Western. And to be honest, it was one of the best decisions because it taught me to really, work. And I know that sounds a little like, well, would you not have worked if you were at Michigan? But the way I started to perceive things was, you know, these larger schools, these Big Ten schools, SEC schools, the guys, the competition, although it's great, they're kind of, I started to put myself into this mentality of, yeah, but it's given to them. Everything is given to them. They don't work like me. And that was kind of my mind manipulation that I had all my collegiate career, all throughout, so that I could prove when time came that I would not be outworked. I was not going to be outperformed. And I was going to ultimately win.
And that's great. And I think that actually, once I got to know you quite well working on Sky Sports and on the NFL UK live tours that we did, you're very committed, you're very driven. And I read about your college career that you were on the debate team. That doesn't surprise me. You're an excellent speaker. But I was interested to see you kind of taught yourself for some of your credits. And you kind of really drove yourself through college, didn't you? And you end up being a second round draft pick of the Green Bay Packers. Have you always been really kind of a self-motivator and a hard worker like that?
Yeah, I look at life as a great opportunity to be inspired, and as well as an opportunity for us to inspire. And so for me, I was inspired by what I had saw, what I had seen, what I wanted, and it drove me. That's what drove it. To this day, that's what drives me, being inspired, seeing what I want, figuring out a way of approach to get there, and executing that game plan. And I think that's the game of life. No matter what profession, no matter what career path you decide, it's about seeing yourself where you want to be and really committing to the process or the journey of getting there. Mm.
What was it like when you heard your name called by the Green Bay Packers?
Oh, Neil. Oh, you want the truth? Or you want me to just tell you something that I just can make up?
Give me the truth. Give me the unedited truth. I know now, Greg, I know you're an honest speaker, so I know you can give me the truth.
Okay, so I got to take you back to the day before draft. So the day before draft, I get a call from this 920 number, area code. It's someone from Green Bay just making sure that this was going to be my working phone that I had in hand for draft day. That's protocol across the board for teams that are potentially going to draft a guy. So I got a lot of calls from a lot of different teams. But for whatever reason, I remember this 920 area code primarily because that morning or the morning of the draft, myself and Jerome Harrison, who was a fifth round draft pick, we went to high school together. From the Cleveland Browns, we sat down at breakfast and he says, "Where is it that you just don't want to go?" And I'm like, "Green Bay. I don't want to go to Green Bay." I kid you not. I'm like, "Exactly." I'm like, I've lived in Michigan my entire life. We trained in Florida and I had gotten so comfortable with the warm weather. I'm like, "Man, I just want to go somewhere warm, decent weather. I don't want to go to Green Bay. I hated the colors. I didn't like Brett Favre because I was a Michigan boy. He ruined Thanksgivings for me." Like, it just, all of this played a part. So draft night comes, or draft day is here, and, you know, I'm sitting with my family and I see the tickers going by. And I see the Green Bay Packers, they have the 37th pick or something like that in the first round. Or in the second round, I'm sorry. And yeah, it's only 32 teams, not 37, FYI. So
good knowledge. Thanks for that.
So I'm looking and I'm like, "Oh man, I get a call from my agent. He's like, "I think the Packers are gonna take you here." Turns out they end up trading Javon Walker to Denver and worked out some deal. It was the Denver Broncos were going to take me there. They end up trading the Green Bay Packers for Jerome Walker, and I didn't go. I look at the ticker again, and the Green Bay Packers have like the 50th pick. And I'm like, okay, well, they don't have a receiver, so maybe I go there. They end up selecting Darren College. And I'm like, okay, perfect. I scaved. I ran away from the Green Bay Packers. And the ticker keeps going, and I see they have the 52nd pick. And I kid you not, in that moment, I knew you're going to end up in Green Bay.
You just know.
And sure enough, my phone rings before the 52nd pick. And now, mind you, this is my approach. This is my thought process. I've said all of what I didn't want to happen as far as going and landing in Green Bay prior to. The moment my phone rings, they're like, Greg, we're thinking we're going to take you here at the 52nd pick. Are you excited? You want to be a Packer? I'm like, absolutely. I want to be. I can't wait.
You lied.
Everything from that moment on was like, yeah, I can't wait. I've been waiting for this moment all my life. I've always wanted to be a Packer.
Well, that's it. You might as well go for it then.
Absolutely. But the reality of it was, is that in and of itself, it could not have been a better landing spot for me, man. It was amazing to play with Brett, to work alongside him. It jump-started my career. The rest is history.
So from, shall we say, feigning his delight at becoming a cheesehead, the romantic inside of me would like to think Greg arrived at Lambeau Field, saw this iconic stadium before him, and fell in love with the idea of being in the cold of Wisconsin. But he didn't. It took him a little while longer to settle as the Packers went 8-8 in his rookie year. But it wasn't long before the flames of love really took over, though, as the Packers began to find their feet and Greg felt at home.
You know, to be honest, it really wasn't until my second year. And the reason why I say that is because my first year, we were an 8-8 football team. We experienced some wins, some highs, some lows. But that second year, we were a really good team. Ended up getting to the NFC Championship game and losing to the New York Giants. But that year, you kind of felt what Green Bay was all about. The fans, the winning, getting to the playoffs. Like, everything was all about the Green Bay Packers. And it wasn't as though that wasn't the case the year before. But it's different when you win. You get to really experience kind of the red carpet, if you will, of an organization or of a franchise or surrounding the franchise. And everywhere we went, it was just red carpet rollout, red carpet treatment. And I got to see Brett in a different light. The year before, you know, I remember playing and I'm standing next to him and we played the Philadelphia Eagles and we're warming up. And I just remember looking at them and I'm telling them, I'm like, this is why I love that you're my teammate, because I don't have this jaw dropping moment, or I don't become in awe at things because I'm practicing and playing with you. So I appreciate you for that. And the next year we're winning. And it was Brett Favre everything. And he had all these benchmarks and these individual records that he was breaking. And I was on the end of them, a lot of them. And it really kind of catapulted and jump-started my career. But I got to experience not only the Green Bay Packer mystique of winning and just the history and all that kind of goes with winning in Green Bay, but I'm doing it and I'm a part of these record setting moments with the greatest quarterback in arguably the greatest quarterback in the franchise's history, outside of obviously at that time, Bart Starr before he. And so I'm having this experience and it was so surreal. To where you kind of take it for granted. I was enjoying the ride, don't get me wrong, but I never really got to sit back and really assess and analyze and reflect. Because from then on, it was Greg Jennings, the next. And Brett would make some comments about if he were playing longer, we would break all kind of, and I'm just, from there, my career just took off, and the Green Bay Packer aura and mystique just, it really showed itself.
I'm glad you listed, mentioned some of those big catches, because I've listed them here. September 2006, you have a 75-yard touchdown. That's Brett Favre's 400. September 23rd, 2007, you catch number 420, which ties Dan Marino. A week later, September the 30th, you catch the touchdown that gives Brett Favre the all-time touchdown pass record. November 29th, 2007, you catch the first career touchdown pass of Aaron Rodgers. These are all big plays for you, but they're all plays where you probably didn't keep the football. That last one probably went to Aaron Rodgers. The others, the guy with the white gloves comes out and takes it off to Canton, Ohio, right? I mean, those would normally be big plays, and they'd be sitting on your shelf right now.
Yes. All moments, and that those were the takeaways. It was beautiful because I knew that I was just a part of the big picture, you know. I was on the receiving end of, 520, 521. And when that happened, I just thought about, I'm playing next to Donald Driver. He's caught numerous touchdowns from Brett Favre. I'm in the locker room at times with Robert Brooks. He would be there, Antonio Freeman. And I'm thinking of all these Packer great receivers that played a role. And then it just so happened I come around at the right time, and I'm like, boop, oh, Greg Jennings. And I'm attached, my name is attached to history. And it was this combustion that I could not have scripted or drawn up myself. It was amazing, man. So he deserved every one of those balls. And Aaron Rodgers, I was more than willing. This is your first time. I've done this before, buddy. Here you go.
As Greg mentioned earlier in our chat, hailing from Michigan, he was not a Brett Favre fan, but from ruining Thanksgivings in his teenage years when the Detroit Lions would always play on that national holiday, Favre was pivotal in helping shape Greg's NFL career. And sharing the locker room with a Green Bay and NFL legend was among the highlights of Greg's career.
As a player, you couldn't ask for a better teammate, and a better performer under pressure, and also a better leader that could really put you at ease. Like, you knew you were in good hands with Brett, even though he threw the interception in the NFC Championship game.
Yeah.
and we would ride with him no matter what. You know, he had moments where, just like we've all had, where there were highs and lows, but his highs, man, you went on such a ride with his highs that you forget that there was a low that was going to come, because he just didn't care about the play before.
Right.
He was on to the next one. And that's really, when you think about it from that perspective, Brett Favre, the player, and the teammate, and then in the locker room, that's just kind of how he lived his life. It's like,
was he a joker?
He was, oh my, you know, yes. All he did was pranks. He pranked everyone. And there was really nothing you could do because, I mean, it was Brett. So you really weren't going to get him back. Very few guys were going to prank Brett. It was just, okay, you got to let him do what he does. And he was the greatest storyteller I think I've ever been around. He just had a way of just capturing you in that and bringing that moment to life right then and there. And it was like, man, I never knew that I wanted to hunt. And I would go, and it's like he would draw you in and make you feel like you were a part of whatever story he was telling.
We'll be back with more from Greg after this short break.
Hi, I'm Bruce Arians, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Welcome back to the Neil Reynolds Podcast. Now, before the break, we heard from Greg Jennings on the experience of playing with a Hall of Fame quarterback in Brett Favre. That, of course, has its benefits, but the downside to any career is that Father Time catches up. All great careers come to an end. The same happened for Favre, who had to begrudgingly pass the baton to Aaron Rodgers. Witnessing that take place from within the Green Bay locker room must have been distracting for Jennings. Or maybe not.
You know, I can sit here and say, no, it wasn't a distraction. And ultimately, it was not, because we did everything we possibly could within our power as players to not allow it to be a distraction. And that was really deflecting and deferring to Mike McCarthy and Ted and let them handle that. And the way Aaron handled that entire situation made it so easy for us to continue to deflect. He was the consummate pro in that situation. He got booed when he took the practice field. He got booed when he took the field on family night. He got booed just for being the next man up, something that we all experienced at some point in our careers. And we all hope that whether you're a parent, whether you're a fan, whether you have dreams and aspirations to be in professional sport or whatever it is, you want to be the guy. You want to be the girl. And he just happened to be the next one in line. And now he's hated because Brett decided to walk away. And so that really galvanized us. It really drew us even closer. And I think the rapport that we were able to establish with one another, the relationship that we were able to build because of that, was monumental. And it all stemmed from just how he was treated. And it was so wrong. Because here it is, I'm a receiver I'm not going to remove Donald Driver, but I'm going to kind of start being the guy. Well, are they going to boo me? So we could all relate to where he was. We hadn't all experienced that, but it was like, nah, man, this isn't right. And so it really brought us closer together as a team. And we made some special things happen, even in that first year, without making the playoffs.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you that next. There was a kind of period there from 2009 to 2011. I was at the wild card game against Arizona. You were outstanding. You went for 130 and a touchdown. You win the Super Bowl. I'll ask you about that in a second. Pro Bowls were in that period as well. Did you feel like you were right at the top of your game in those few years there?
No doubt about it. No question. And again, like I said, it all started from just my development with Brett, my experiences with him being in the media rooms and understanding what quarterbacks at that level of in that elite play were expecting of a receiver and how to play the game like a quarterback. And so once Aaron jumped under center, under the helm, it was like, all right, let's go. Don't let's not fall off, because we had a group of receivers that could really make things happen for pretty much any quarterback, we believe. And so for us, for myself in particular, I just felt like I couldn't be stopped. That was just the mindset, and that was the approach. Every time we went to practice, it was the competitive atmosphere that we set amongst one another, whether we were in the locker room playing cards, whether we were on the plane, on the road playing cards, competing on the field. It transferred always on Sundays and Mondays. And it made the game that much easier.
I mean, you've told me this before when we were on the tour and we were driving around the country, just about how sometimes with quarterbacks, you don't want to kind of get them off the, or you want to get them off the spot. And you've said you'd never want to get Aaron Rodgers off the spot but that must have meant you would really have to be in tune with him as he's moving around. And you've talked about that before. You had real chemistry, didn't you? Kind of. Not anything kind of psychic, but you knew what he was doing and you knew what he was thinking, right?
I did. I mean, and I would like to say we all pretty much were on the same page, but there was a level of trust that I feel like we had that I developed with Aaron. And it's important, because when a quarterback is forced out of the pocket, they can't panic. So they can't see panic in you. And you have to have a calmness and kind of an assurance in, okay, I'm going to get open. Give me a second. And he has to trust that, okay, he's going to work himself open. I got to get rid of the ball. Okay, let it go. And so we started because of Brett, really, originally. We used to practice off-schedule plays because in practice, you know, the whistle would blow if Bajaj Miller or anyone would get a sack. McCarthy would like, keep playing. And Brett would scramble. And then Aaron was so good at it. He did it all the time. And he became, if not still is, the most accurate quarterback I've seen outside of the pocket, on the run, running to his left, running to his right, pressure in his face, and still putting the ball on the money or in a place where only his receiver can get it. It was something we had to implement, as almost like those were plays we became to know.
This is a question that, yeah, us mortals that haven't done it like to ask, and it's a very simple question. But what's it like to stand under the confetti when you've won the Super Bowl, and actually not to just have won the Super Bowl and been one of the 53, but to catch 4 passes, 2 touchdowns, 60 plus yards, to have played a major role in lifting the Vince Lombardi Trophy? What was that like when that confetti's coming down?
So the second half of the question was my experience, obviously. And that's the perspective that I have to answer. It was surreal. Because you dream about, man, everyone that has an opportunity to play in a game like that, a championship, they want to have an impact. They want to leave that lasting impression because of some play or plays that they made to help their team become victorious. And that was my experience. It was so surreal to know the night before I'm laying in my bed and I'm just envisioning myself scoring touchdowns or a touchdown. I would have been content with one, and to get 2. And then on top of that, to trump that, to make the biggest play in the game, to help my team keep that momentum, that 3rd-and-10 conversion trumps either one of those touchdown catches that I had in that game. And so to be a part of that game in and of itself was one thing, but to actually be an impact player in that game, that was special. That's something that my kids have watched, even though they were young. My son wasn't even born, and he's seen it. And then the confetti to be holding my older 2 daughters and watching their expression and sharing that moment with them, it was everything that you would hope it would have been when you draw it up or when you dream about it or imagine it. It was even more.
Did you keep the confetti? Did you pick some up?
You know what? You're the second person that has ever asked me that, and I didn't keep any of it. It literally didn't dawn on me for a second to grab any of the confetti. And every time, like, I've heard that now twice, you being the second, I'm like, what? You didn't even think, grab a little bit.
So from witnessing the end of Green Bay careers like Favre's, Greg would himself experience his own departure. And it wasn't in the way he hoped. The events that followed would hurt Greg. His departure would change some of the relationships he had formed after years of success at Lambeau Field, notably with his quarterback, Aaron Rodgers.
You know, I felt like I had given the organization some great production, that I was a guy that had done everything the right way, both on the field, off the field, and that it would play out different than what it did. And that was my hope. I wanted to end my career as unrealistic as it may sound and be, as a Green Bay Packer. I wanted to be there for the entirety of my career, and understanding the business, in that moment, not really knowing that part of the business because I had yet to be exposed to it.
Right.
It was tough because it hurt because I felt like in that moment, the guy who I had made plays for, that we had developed so much chemistry, had developed the relationship on and off the field. I felt like, you know, he kind of walked away from it. He closed his mouth. He closed his eyes to it and didn't just whisper anything. And that really bothered me because of the way it played out. I'm not going to get into the whole details of it, but it wasn't just that. It was, you know, a story that I've told before that he said for another team to come and get me. And I felt like he was kind of assisting with the push of me, of my exit. And all I was thinking was, wait, I was like standing in front, trying to take every dart, every bullet, every negative comment from you when Brett and that whole transition. And it was like, I went to bat. Like I was there. Like I was, and I felt like that wasn't reciprocated. And the most important, you know what? I've since gotten over it. And even when I exited in the way that I did, and then leaving and saying and sharing some of the intel and insight that I had and I shared, it was all from a place of being angry, being hurt. And hurt people, you know, like that's just the reality. And I was hurt. And so I wanted somebody else to be hurt. And not that what I said wasn't true or I was making up fictitious things. But I just wanted them to feel me. And that was a complete wrong approach. It was the immature approach. And since I've apologized and, definitely it put a strain on Aaron and my relationship, which has since started to kind of come around, in the last year. A lot of things that none of what I said do I disagree with, but how I went about it and how I chose to convey it, I disagree with all of it.
Yeah. I mean, you've always been a very honest and straight shooter. I think that's why you're so good in the media now. I love the fact you went to Minnesota, which is obviously that must have been difficult. But you had that big game at Wembley Stadium. I thought that was fantastic how you proved you could still play at such a high level. We see you making the big plays there. As you moved towards the end of your career, did you have an eye on TV? And obviously we then did the NFL UK live tour and I got to know you a bit more then, and you did Sky Sports with us, and now you've gone on to bigger and better things there. But did you have one eye on the media as you moved towards the end?
I did. To be honest, Neil, I felt like the amount of time that I had invested into the game of football, and I tell this to young guys all the time now, there should always be a stream of income. There should always be something that is flowing in from this sport to any player. And it's all about how you take advantage of it. And for me, you know, I had been told, man, you speak very well and you're very good in front of the camera and all of these various things. And I really just played to it. And I allowed what everyone else had said in my comfort being in front of the camera or behind a microphone to just take me to where it has taken me. And There's been bumps in the road. It hasn't always been smooth. there's been a learning curve. There always will be a learning curve. If I want to always continue to get better and continue to improve, I will make sure that there remains a learning curve. And like I mentioned earlier, just continue to be inspired by others who do it. And to inspire those who behind me look at who are watching me in the way that I'm doing it, making sure that I'm doing it the right way.
Well, you were dynamite on stage on NFL UK Live. One of my favorite guests ever. I'll say that now.
I appreciate it. I know you're only saying that because I'm on the other end of this.
Well, I say right it now. To, yeah, I mean, I'll say it to somebody else next week. That's just how it goes. So I'm interested to know how it works with, you know, the TV commentary now. You do the color stuff for Fox, and this is the bit I want to kind of get, because you have to sit in production meetings with head coaches, but I know players. Let me just take the example of the Dallas Cowboys recently. The players criticizing Mike McCarthy and his coaching mm-hmm. staff. As a player, you would have had a view on Mike McCarthy, the coach. And I'm not asking you to share it now at all, but you also have to be Greg Jennings, the color analyst for Fox, who might sit in a production meeting with Mike McCarthy. Do you kind of get what I'm getting at? You would have had an opinion as a player.
Of course.
So how do you balance things like that?
Well, the way I handle it is I am just me. Neil, that's in what I mean by that, I don't mean that in an arrogant way, a conceited way. I treat people with respect, and I try to allow them to see that who I am is who I am, whether you're sitting in front of me or whether you're 10,000 miles away from me. And Mike McCarthy, he understands that. Players sometimes they don't really understand that in the moment. But when you're on this side of it and you have now, you can understand and you have a greater appreciation for the perspective of players, but also for the perspective of front office and head coach and in the media as well. And you kind of have to walk that line, understanding that you have to give both their opportunity to at least share their piece, but you always have to be honest and in a tasteful way, in a way that is receivable. And there's a way to do that. And I feel like I will never, and I've learned a lot, even with the way I handled the exiting of the Green Bay situation of not making that mistake again, but still being able to get my point across and ask the hard question, but the right way.
I was very interested to see you've been involved in the bodybuilding and recently won, was it Mr. Minnesota?
Correct.
Is that right? Yes. Correct. Yeah. So you're Mr. Minnesota. Is that what was the thinking behind that? Is it just another form of competition, another form of challenging yourself? Does it fill a bit of a void that's not there with the NFL anymore? What was the thinking?
So to be honest, it definitely filled that competitive desire. And not that I needed football, because I mean, to be honest, I have not missed football since I walked away from it. But I believe that I had begun to miss competing not only against others, but against myself. And my wife kind of inspired that. She jumped into a marathon and didn't even know she was running a full marathon, thought she had signed up for a half. And wow. She had never been a runner. And she challenged herself to do something that was completely outside of the realm that she would be in of comfort. And I looked at myself as she crossed that finish line like, well, what are you going to do? And that's kind of how it all sparked for me. And the rest is history. It's really become a lifestyle. It's become kind of this way of, like I said, a lifestyle, because now my health fitness and self-care is always at the forefront versus being secondary and or something that I do just to perform a sport. Like I did it and I took care of all of what I needed to take care of because of football. Now I'm doing it because I truly desire to be healthy and fit.
So there's my conversation with Greg Jennings. I told you he was honest. I told you he was forthright. And let's bring in producer Gary Hayes for the mailbag. Gary, he was very good value. I've always found Greg to be a great interview. He's very thoughtful, but not afraid to put his opinions out there.
No, it was an excellent listen. And it was a pleasure to edit it. Some great stories there about Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers and getting that inside perspective on what happens when one dynasty has to pass over to another.
Yeah, because it was an awkward time, so it was very very good to get Greg's take on that. Let's go into the mailbag then. What have you got for us this week?
Well, what I want to ask is, are you going to be as open and honest as Greg was with these questions?
I don't know. I'm going to take it one question at a time. I'm just going to try and get better with each question.
That's a perfect locker room response there.
Exactly. I'm not going to get too high with one question or too low with the other. I'm going to try and stay in the middle.
Yeah, let's take each game as it comes. Right, yeah. So Fionn Duffield on Twitter asks, I hope I pronounced your name correct as well there, Fionn. I've said it wrong again if I have. What was your first game you covered as a professional journalist and when?
Okay.
This is when we get to know how old you are.
Yeah, exactly. So it was the London Monarchs in week two of the 1992 NFL Europe season at home against the Frankfurt Galaxy. Then I started to cover the Monarchs sort of on and off through that season. That was at the old Wembley Stadium. I went on the road in week 10. I was the only journalist that traveled to Frankfurt again, but I went, the newspaper I was doing it for, First Down newspaper, was a bit low on budget. So I had to travel to Frankfurt on the fan bus. So there was a coach trip for the fans and I was on the bus. So we...
Did you get involved in any shenanigans with the fans?
I didn't, although I was very responsible for shenanigans. So what happened was we drove overnight, arrived in Frankfurt on the Saturday morning. Literally had slept on the bus. Then the fans were, obviously I went to the press box, the fans were getting on it all day on the booze. Then when we left, we were like, it must have been about midnight, and we were going to drive back through the night, and there were two fans missing off the bus. And the bus driver was like, we need to go, we're going to miss our ferry if we don't get back, we don't do all this, blah, blah. What should I do? And I was like, I don't know, I'm 19 years old. It's the first time I've ever gone on the road and done a press trip in my life. Why am I suddenly in charge? He was like, it's up to you. Do we go or stay? I was like, oh, I don't know. I was like, well, what do you think? And everyone was like, go, leave them. So I was like, well, go then, let's go. I was like, and then, so we're driving. We'd only got about 5 minutes out of the stadium. And suddenly these two fans come running across the road on this like dual carriageway, waving down the bus, and they made it anyway. So that was lucky. My first ever NFL game was an American Bowl, Detroit and Dallas, 93 at the old Wembley again, ended in a tie. My first NFL games that I reported on in the US, I'd been on my honeymoon in 97, but I went on a press trip to Indianapolis in 1998. It was a rookie year of Peyton Manning, who went number one in the draft, and Ryan Leaf. So it was the Colts against the Chargers in 98. That was on the Sunday. On the Monday, we flew up to Green Bay to watch Minnesota thrash the Packers at Lambeau Field. Randy Moss had a big night, coming out night for Randy Moss there in early in his career. I've got another travel note actually about that trip up to Green Bay if you want it.
Does it involve your travel companion watching Towie at the end of it? Because if it does, I don't want to hear it.
No, but it does involve another nightmare flight from hell. We haven't had many of them, but this one, we were on one of those again, the little twin prop planes, because from Indianapolis to Green Bay is not that far. So it was a really small plane, which meant it couldn't get up above 10,000 feet, I think. And basically, we bounced through the clouds the whole way. And sitting next to me was a priest who kept crossing himself. I was like, if you're doing that, I was like, Jesus. Well, yeah, actually, probably was literally Jesus was who he was calling, and so was I. So, yeah.
What was the in-flight movie, Alive?
No, there was, yeah, exactly. Luckily, there wasn't one because it was only about a 45-minute flight. So that's there's a lot. I've covered off NFL Europe, home and away, NFL in the UK and NFL in the US. See, I told you I'd be open.
Well, hopefully Fionn is happy with the response.
Mm.
Okay, so on to Daryl Slynn. Daryl asks, what is your most memorable moment from the London Games, which is topical because that'd be happening right now, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they would. Few for you. Blake Bortles throwing a late touchdown pass to Alan Hearns to give the Jags their first win in London. They led massive big lead against Buffalo. Then Buffalo came back, took the lead late, and we're like, oh, the Jags are never going to win in London. Bortles throws up this pass, which Alan Hearns dives full length to catch. And then falls face first into the turf, comes up with a grass all covering his face, which I found amusing because he'd told me earlier that summer in an interview he was actually allergic to grass. So that was a nice little side note. I think the Matt Prater kicking the field goal at the end of the game for Detroit, so against Atlanta. Atlanta led 21-0 at the half. Detroit came back and won by a point, very similar to a game we had recently in the NFL where Prater decided that between the Lions and the Falcons. This won't mean much to our American listeners, but it will to the British listeners. In 2017, when the fans paid tribute to Kevin Cadle, my longtime partner on Sky Sports, who died the week leading up to the Cardinals and Rams game. It was a very emotional weekend for me and for the fans. To see everyone come together and pay tribute to Kev was incredible. And the last one would be just the fans, just the fan rallies I've been able to host, standing on stage in Trafalgar Square, looking out at 15,000 people, looking down Regent Street on the stage and seeing, you know, 500,000 people during the course of that day was incredible. So I've got lots of great memories.
It's funny because you say about the fans and you do meet a lot of characters at the London Games. And there's a character that I've met in the press box. I forget his name. I think it's Jerry. And he does stuff like for ESPN and a few others. And he wears
shouldn't be a fan if he's in the press box.
Well, no. What I mean is just a character. just a character. But he does stuff like ESPN and others. And he wears these like really flamboyant Hawaiian shirts every year. Fitz has probably given them to him, like that one he gave you. And he's always got like a dodgy cap on. But what he does, on top of all of that, he takes all the lunches at the end. When there's, like, you know, they put the lunches out in the press box and he just goes along and takes about 10 of them. And you see him waddling down Wembley Way with all these lunch bags. And I'm like, Jerry, like, nicking all the lunches, man.
Wow. Yeah. And you named and shamed him.
Well, I can't remember if his name's Jerry because last year I plucked up the courage to speak to him for the first time. We were in the queue for the locker room. And I started chatting to him and he's actually a really nice guy. So I sort of forgave him for stealing all the lunches. But there you go. That's my London story.
I honestly don't know what to say. I have worked with, and I'm not naming names, I've worked with a player on Sky Sports who, when they used to, the runner used to come around and offer us sandwiches, he would eat one and take two more and put, then he'd have a carrier bag under his desk. I was like, what are you doing with that? It's like, that'd be my dinner during the week. So, wow. I thought it was good life in the NFL. But
well, he's got it sorted. Right, so last question is from a youngster called Kirit Pooney. Now, I think this is a new feature on the podcast, Neil, and a new feature for the mailbag, because rather than send his question in as a tweet, he sent it in as a video.
I saw it. It was great.
And we're just going to play the audio from that right now.
Okay.
Who's the best player you've interviewed?
So there you go, Neil. Who is the best player you've interviewed in the NFL?
Well, I've interviewed... I've been very fortunate. I've interviewed... Yeah, some of the biggest names, the biggest names in the sport. But, you know, if everyone's going to say Tom Brady's the GOAT, and I would agree with that, then I have interviewed Tom Brady, and he was absolutely charming. It was really fascinating interview, actually. It was in the summer of 2012. And you think, you kind of, the Patriots were like, you're only going to have 10 minutes with Tom. You know, it's 10 minutes, start your clock when he comes in, that kind of thing. And, yeah, that, I get it. That's their job. They're the ones that play the bad guy. And then Tom can come in and do whatever Tom wants. And he was great. The interview was good. He was talking about how he was still hungry. That classic line, you know, what's your best favorite Super Bowl? And he said the next one. He was really good. But he also, we spent a lot of time. It was It was the summer of 2012. So Tom spent about 5 minutes at the start talking about the London Olympics and, you know, just talking about the, I can't remember his name, but the 800 meter runner who won gold and, you know, how he basically sprinted around the track for two laps at full speed and won gold medal. But yeah, Tom was just great. He couldn't have been happier in that environment. And that's when you know you've got a good interview. Yeah, a couple of weeks back, I interviewed Aaron Rodgers, as everyone would have seen, I'm sure, across social media. You know, very early on, Aaron Rodgers, unprompted, started talking about when he walked into a bar in Paris. And, you know, it was a Packers bar. And suddenly all the heads turn when Aaron Rodgers walks in and starts drinking with them. When they start telling you stories unprompted, you know you've got a good one. So, Kirut, I would say Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers would be right up there for me as the best.
And just to say, if anyone else wants to send videos in now instead of actual questions, then we'll pick the best ones and we'll run the audio on this and put it straight to you, Neil.
I like it. We're evolving. We're evolving.
We'll have to call it the Kirut section or something like that, just to give him a credit, because it's something he's done and now we've stolen it.
Sponsored by Kirut.
Yeah, there you go.
Does he give us 20 grand for that? No, that's not our sponsorship.
No,
I
think we're meant to spend it the other way around, didn't we?
Oh, okay.
But Kirut, you're not getting 20 grand, just to make that clear.
Cool, so we're done for this week. Next up is going to be my good friend, and good friend of so many people in the UK as well, because they're so popular as a group. It's going to be Mark Sessler from the Around the NFL podcast. We've had Dan on, Gary, so we might as well go with...
Mark on Game Picks a few weeks ago, and it was the first time I'd had the privilege of really speaking to him, and absolutely loved having him on there. So I'm looking forward to this episode.
Yeah, no, it'd be great. So thanks to you, Gary. Thanks to Greg Jennings, of course. He was a great guest this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye for now. This episode was hosted by myself, Neil Reynolds. Our producer is Gary Hayes, while Matt Alabaster is responsible for all of our artwork. Taylor Hayes mixed this episode and also composed our theme music. Special thanks to junior producer Henry Smith and everyone else involved in helping us put this episode together. The Neil Reynolds Podcast is a Highway 61 production for the Reynolds Podcast Network.